Okay, great, and nice to see you all this early. So I'm going to be talking today how to make binary black holes, and I'm a stellar theorist, so these are coming from stars, so I don't understand primordial black holes at all, so I won't be discussing them. But if we just start with a simple picture, right? You've got two black holes. You want them to merge within the age of the universe. They kind of need to be, right, when you form the black holes, about 60 solar radii apart to be able to merge with gravitational waves. The problem is, if you put two stars at 60 solar radii, at some point, they're going to merge on the red giant branch, which is not what we want to see, right? It's an interesting merger, but it's not a black hole merger. So one of the stars will evolve onto the red giant branch. You'll get up to about 1,000 solar radii, which is therefore going to consume your second star, and you won't have a binary black hole anymore. So there are a couple of ways to kind of avoid this process. So the first obvious answer is you just put the stars further apart to start with. So if you start with two stars at 1,000 solar radii, one star can then evolve onto its red giant phase, get really big, but the stars are now further enough apart that they don't merge. Instead, you get some mass transfer. You lose basically all the hydrogen off your first star, and you end up with a helium core left over with the second star. That helium core then explodes in some sort of supernovae. And then you've got the problem, right, that your two star, well, your star and your black hole is now, say, 1,000 solar radii apart, so you need to bring them in close enough that they're going to merge. So you have to go through a common envelope. So the star, this time you do want the star to expand on its red giant and to bring the black hole in close. You know, we don't completely understand what's going on in common envelope, but somehow the envelope gets ejected, and now you put a black hole around the helium core at around 60 solar radii. So when this one becomes a black hole in the supernova, you've now got two black holes that are close enough that they'll merge within Hubble time. So that's one way to do things. The second way to do them is through what's called the chemically homogeneous evolution. So in this case, what you do is you actually do start with two stars really close together this time, and you go, well, let's try and stop them going through the red giant phase. So for particular ranges of mass and periods, you put the two stars close enough together, they will actually spin themselves up through tidal forces. And this is what my nice little cartoon's showing. And basically what's happening is you continuously basically mix the hydrogen from the surface into the core and then the helium out to the surface. So because you're doing this mixing, you never basically build up a core or an envelope in the star. So you don't actually basically skip the red giant phase. You just slowly burn hydrogen into helium. Your stars don't expand much, so you can keep your two helium stars very close together. And then each star explodes in a supernova. And now, because you started really close at the start, you can then merge them together. And if people have questions, please interrupt me as I go. So that's one way. So this is kind of ways to do it with binary stars. And of course, there's lots of other ways. If you have things like triples, you could, you know, in this thing, maybe you can, if you have a triple star system, you might be able to avoid the common envelope. If you have all sorts of interactions, that's kind of getting into the dynamical mergers at that point, where you start just using n-body interactions to bring your stars in close. So one thing I've kind of skipped over, of course, at this point is what happens at this point is the, you know, the explosion phase. What's happening? How do you go from a star to a black hole? So how do you explode a star, and what happens, and what's left over at the end? So this is just a nice plot from Norbert Langer from his review paper, looking at how different stars are going to end up. So this is a core density, core temperature plot. So your low mass stars at this end, they evolve, basically stars evolve from here upwards on the line. They're going to make white dwarfs, electron capture supernovae, normal supernovae. And what I'm interested in is kind of the ones at this region on this. Do we have a pointer or anything? Right, is the stuff kind of here. So you have a several hundred solar mass star, evolves up this way, ends up going into this region, which we call the parent stability region. So the stars at this point, they're basically supported by radiation pressure, so photons. But you start getting up this point, your photons start having enough energy to make electron-positron pairs. So you turn your photons to an electron and a positron. That takes away the pressure support in the star, so the star starts to collapse. And then if you go really high, you can start making black holes again, but I'll get to that in a minute. So what's happening? So this is kind of just a schematic of what's going on. So you've got your massive star, it starts making electron positrons, it contracts, a gas contracting heats up, you ignite oxygen basically in the core explosively. This starts generating shocks, shocks propagate outwards, and then you start basically losing mass from the surface of your star. And then once you've done this, you lose a bit of mass, your star will contract back again because it starts cooling down, and you basically repeat this loop a few times. Eventually you run out of oxygen, so then you just proceed to normal core collapse. So basically just a direct collapse to a black hole at the end. But if you make your star a bit more massive, right, when you ignite the oxygen is so violent that you basically blow your star up completely in just one go, and you basically get a pair instability supernova, which doesn't leave anything behind. And the important, interesting thing for us here with the black holes is that, right, the pair, this thing going through the pulsational system leaves black holes, but the pair instability don't leave anything. So that means there's going to be a cutoff in the black holes. Right, the pair instability supernova mean you stop making black holes. I mean, you'll eventually make black holes again at 140 solar mass black holes, but for now, let's just say you stop making black holes. But the pulsational pair instability are set in how much mass this black hole will have. Right, because this black hole is set by the mass at this point, which is set by how much mass you lose in the pulses.
How many cycles in principle are possible?
So in terms of losing mass, maybe 1 to 10 cycles. You can actually be at the very low mass. You can start to do this and you don't lose mass. You just kind of oscillate the core, It's not violent enough to lose mass, but the core will kind of contract, expand, and that can be a large number. So again, it depends on the mass. So the biggest ones will do fewest pulses, and they'll have a very long time between them. So 100,000 years, thousands and thousands of years kind of between the pulses, because it takes a long time to cool down. Whereas if you're in lower masses, you lose less mass, and the pulse is basically less violent. So you do lots of short ones, and then that's days, weeks, months time scale. So of course, these are interesting pulses for CSM people and interaction supernovae. Yes? So these will go basically, direct collapse to a black hole. But interestingly, right, these pulses, you might actually still be pulsating at the point. You might still have actually pulses going out at the same time that the star's collapsing. So it's So if we just draw a quick kind of schematic of what's going on, so just as a function of star mass and black hole mass, and if you didn't think any of this existed, right, you would get some function, probably not a straight line, but you get some function for the black hole mass. But because you've got these pulses going on which start to drive mass off the star, you basically get a turnover in what the black hole mass is doing. And then eventually transition into this parent stability region, which is leaving nothing behind. So this is what I'm saying, that the parent stability region sets that there is going to be some limit, because you just can't keep, you know, you make a more massive star, you're not going to make a more massive black hole. But the pulsational parent stability is setting where this limit is. Right? LIGO is going to be measuring some function of the left-hand axis, the black hole mass. So where the pulse is, what kind of mass the star is left after the pulse is, sets what the maximum black hole will be. And it's, you can't quite see the difference, but it's also that actually you don't, it's not necessarily that the biggest star will actually make the biggest black hole. Things slightly smaller will probably actually be making the black hole. And that just comes down to the combination of how many pulses, how violent they are, how much mass you're losing before the final collapse. So this is just in single star black hole mass, but LIGO, of course, is measuring chirp masses. So this is just some kind of back of the envelope predictions, what the shape of the chirp mass distribution would be. So chirp mass against the NDM. So this is just kind of assuming the IMF. And the thing to remember, right, you've got two stars in a binary, you basically got three combinations. Either neither star goes through these pulses, one star goes through the pulse, or both stars goes through the pulse. So you start to see, so the blue is no pulses, red is kind of one star pulsating, and green is two stars pulsating. And you start to see little bumps, but if you fold in LIGO's volume sensitivity, which is going as m to the 2.2, which almost exactly cancels the IMF, which is going as m to the minus 2.2, 2.3, you basically start, you flatten out this distribution, and then you start to see these peaks are forming. And these peaks are coming from basically black holes at these, but basically the edges. Basically, there's going to be some kind of pileup of black holes at these edge points, just because of how, I mean, on this one, it's going up, but sometimes it will go down because of just how the pulse interacts with the mass loss. So that's...
How does this change in the binary scenario in the sense that if you want both of them to go...
Yeah, so that's what this is doing. So this is showing if both of them are going to...
If you want one of them to go through a common envelope to get them close enough.
So none of this is assuming... So actually, none of this actually assumes what the common envelope does. We've assumed that you've done the common envelope and you've just got a helium star. This is really just what happens at the explosion. This doesn't actually care so much about how you got to the point. It just assumes that you've got to a point where you've got a helium star without any of the hydrogen left. And again, I mean, this is kind of first order back of the envelope predictions rather than detailed modeling. But so next thing to ask is, you know, has LIGO seen anything yet? So this is from one of the Abbott papers with the O2 results. So this is mass, the mass predicted for the black hole against a rate. And what they're doing here is basically taking different assumptions for what they think the mass distribution of black holes is and where they think the cut will be, and then trying to fit that to the data. And the important thing to think is basically here is where these curves are basically dropping to zero, which is where LIGO is suggesting where the gap is. I'd say at 10 observations, you can kind of say there's probably a gap, but you're probably not saying where the gap is accurately. If you go Fishback and Holtz 2017, you're looking at maybe 40 observations before you can really pin down what the where the gap is. But basically, from O2 results, you're looking at 40 to 45, so in a mass range. Which is interesting and something I don't quite understand, because the biggest black hole is actually at 50. Given the quoted numbers, but it does have a large error bar. So there's something going on with how they're doing their fitting, which I don't understand. So that's, is there a gap? And then, right, I'm a Stoa theorist, so I want to know, you know, let's assume that there is a gap. What can we start to learn from this? And what can we tell people about where the gap is? So the first thing to worry about, right, is the black holes. Right, they're coming from stars. One of the big things that sets how a star evolves is the metallicity of the star. But because the black holes take, say, 10 giga-years to merge, we're not actually, you know, even if we can localize the black hole to a galaxy, that galaxy is probably not representative of what it was when the stars were forming, right? The age of the universe, those galaxies have merged, they've evolved. So we probably don't know what the metallicity of these black holes, you know, what the progenitors was. So how does that affect things? So this is what I've been doing. So basically using MESA to run lots and lots of models. So this is the core mass versus black hole mass. So this isn't the initial mass of the star, but for different metallicities, so going from 10 to the minus 5 to about a third solar, which is basically where the pulses stop, you can run your models, work out what your black hole is going to be and get different curves. And the thing to take is where these black lines are. So at the lowest metallicity, basically you make the biggest black holes. And as you increase the metallicity, you start getting more wind mass loss from your stars. And this drives down the limit by from about 46 to 40, which is nice because that's where LIGO was saying it is already. But the important point is that this is kind of the, in a sense, an almost a kind of limit for what we can know, because the black holes we see are from different populations. They're going to be from galaxies with different metallicities. So there is actually going to be a spread. There is no kind of one gap point. There's going to be a spread, and it's at least 10% is where we can drive it from the theory side. And then, of course, you've got this single one, which is GW170729 at 50 solar masses, which in principle, the 90% confidence intervals are pretty big, but let's assume for this talk that this is accurate at this point. You know, we can't really predict what's going on, so can we work out how to move, you know, what sets where this gap is, and can we get a better estimate for the gap or better estimate for this point?
Are those just the more massive pair for each one of those events?
So no, it's both. So they're slightly offset from each other.
Okay, because those masses are highly correlated too.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, this is the LIGO, you know, Duncan said, we have a chat with Duncan at some point about getting better error bars for these things.
I just mean like that 50 one, if it really is low, yeah. The other one is probably high.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe it's perfectly consistent. I would quite like it to be there, but let's just, you know, discuss. And maybe LIGO will find more objects up here. Maybe it won't. Let's just think about what happens if it does. So we can kind of flip the axis a little bit. So now it's just showing the black hole mass against Z. So this is called the environment, right? This is what the universe is giving us, and kind of the spread in the black hole mass. We also have to worry, of course, that we're doing numerical codes. So how good are our numerics? So if you run with different, basically, resolution, space, time, and nuclear network, basically, the limit on our code side is probably a couple of solar masses for pinning down where the mass gap is just from numerical resolution. But then our final thing, right, is the physics, right? Hopefully the universe has only picked one choice for various physics assumptions in the universe. So we can play around with these and see, you know, what's going on. So this is the nuclear reaction rates. This is the wind prescription. So we don't really know how massive stars lose mass. So different people have different formulae for how you do that. This is overshoot, convective overshoot, mixing length alpha. So this is just setting how you do the mixing in your star. This is neutrino rates. This is even the Weinberg angle, because I spent a lot of time fixing neutrinos in MESA, so I wanted to see what would happen. And basically, the short answer is you can ignore all of this physics, right? The variations are pretty small and comparable to your numerical answers, but this rate, right, variation is pretty huge, right? So where the maximum black hole mass is quite sensitive to the nuclear reaction rates. And this is saying nothing about how many objects will get to this point, not saying anything about the black hole rates, or because all of these physics will change how your star evolves and what stars you need to get to the maximum black hole mass. I'm simply saying, where is the maximum? Which is hopefully a relatively simple thing to get from the data.
So your maximum is the threshold for apparent stability?
No, so it's...
The maximum for blowing the star to bits.
Yeah, so this is the maximum from the black hole, but actually it turns out, you can slightly more massive ones will actually do very big pulses, so it will actually make quite small black holes. So it's just the maximum you get, at the end of the super, at the evolution.
Yeah.
Well, the parent stability is here, right? It's the combination of where the parent stability is setting in and how much mass you're going to lose through the pulses. No, so this is, so what we're doing for the black hole mass here is basically saying what's the mass within the binding energy, 10 to the 48 ergs.
And if you go super high masses.
Oh yeah, if you go this way, yeah, we have got them, and you pop up about 140 solar mass black holes at that point, at the upper end.
240 solar mass black holes?
140, yeah. And that's basically because the pairing stability doesn't have sufficient energy to disrupt the star, so the star just collapses.
So Rob, you're trying to resolve these pulsations and how much mass they create.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about doing that with Lisa? Is that challenging?
It is challenging, but you can do it because we can follow the shocks and the physics for setting up the pulses is simple, right? It's just gas collapsing, igniting and expanding. And then we can follow the material as it flows out. And then as it flows out and this goes past the...
You're using Mesa Hydro?
Yeah, Mesa Hydro.
Revolving shot.
Yeah.
Passing through the star. But how do you actually remove mass?
So we take the star. So once we know how much material is above the escape velocity, we take the composition and the entropy profile of the stuff that's bound and make a new star with this. So we don't technically remove the mass, we make a new star for the stuff that stays bound.
But how do you know what's bound or unbound? Because there's still pressure forces that can change.
We compute the escape velocity of the material, right, at each point.
Right. So if it's homologous, that's fine.
Yeah.
But if you still have the pressure, that's changing the velocity of the material.
Right, but what's going to be changing the pressure at this, right, because it's just...
Well, it depends how far out.
Yeah. I mean, these are going out to 10 to the 14 centimeters before.
I'm just curious how you do it.
Yeah.
It sounds not trivial.
Yeah, it's a lot of code in the run star extras. So if we dig a little deeper into the rates, what's setting the rates? So this is another one with the core mass against the black hole mass. And basically what we're doing here is varying different rates within their measured uncertainties. So ReactLib is basically the default MESA rates. And then these things we're all using StarLib. So testing triple alpha, the carbon alpha, and the oxygen 16. And the short answer is that it's the carbon alpha that's mostly setting things. So the pink line is the plus sigma, and this is the minus sigma, and this is what's setting the range on where the gap is. And that's mostly to do with the carbon fraction that you have in the core when it starts to try to pulsate. It's what's setting where these mass points are. If we dig into the carbon alpha rate a bit more, so this is just the maximum for each of the, so if you take just the maximum from these curves and throw in a few more models for just the carbon alpha, so this is the sigma, so this is the median, right, rate, and then this is plus sigmas and minus sigmas, where you can assume this is a Gaussian sigma. You get this nice little curve for where the maximum black hole mass is. This is, approximately what the other terms are doing in terms of the uncertainty. But if you're naive and haven't done the full analysis yet, right, you can simply go, given this black hole is here, right, we cross the line, work out where it would intersect, and it's basically saying that your carbon alpha rate should be maybe 0.8, minus 0.8 sigma from the median, which is not unexpected, right? There's lots of stuff that says we probably need a smaller carbon alpha rate than we've been assuming, or at least some of the theoretical, the experimental results are kind of keep pushing the rate down. But what we can say is, right, given this, or wherever we think the maximum black hole is that LIGO's found, maybe it's here, maybe we see a population somewhere else, we can say basically we put an upper limit on where the rate is. So let's say we found a point, we found a population of objects here, did the drawing, then it means the rate must be at least, you know, minus one, minus two sigma. So we basically can start to rule out this region by the existence of wherever we think the maximum black hole should be, just because of its sheer kind of sensitivity to this rate. So this is just my summary. So the pair instability supernova, what gives you the mass gap, but it's the pulsational pair instability that tell you where that gap is. With some set of default physics in your models, you can get the mass gap is somewhere between 40 and 46 solar masses, depending on the metallicity and the environment you're measuring. It's pretty sensitive to the nuclear physics, so this is my suggestion. You can use the maximum black hole to calibrate, primarily the carbon alpha rate. One interesting thing that people keep saying they want to do, but is use do cosmology with the gap, right? So if you know the maximum black hole shouldn't vary with the environment that you're seeing it in, at least 10%, right? You can use this as a standard siren because you can calculate how bright it is or should be compared with how bright it actually is. And therefore you can start to do cosmology. So thank you. Sure.
When you go through this, are you making the strong statement that essentially the high end of the reaction rate is already ruled out?
Yeah, if you trusted this point, if this one, yeah, you would suggest that this end is ruled out.
Except
yeah.
There's the error bar.
Yeah, you do have to worry about that, but yeah.
Yeah. And then I guess the other question is, right? So this is a small subset of the population. You have to fold in.
Right, but
but any measured mass is a lower limit to the mass limit.
Yeah, you could always think you might find bigger ones. And the big thing to worry about is, so if you have, say, dynamical mergers, if it's the first generation, then you're still fine because they're probably still coming from stars and therefore through this. But if it's significant second, third, fourth mergers, yeah, it spins, yeah.
And so that's what I was going to ask you, what yeah. Maybe even prefer a second, but yeah. Is there any spin signature of these pairs of multi black holes that
I don't know. I mean, they should spin down, and the back of envelope is maybe 30% spin down because of the pulses. But then it depends on whether you're going through the classical massive star or chemically homogeneous and where those spins are.
Because that's the other key trait you need.
Yeah.
You can say, there's a gap in the population of low spin black holes.
Yeah.
You can find something that's heavier, but it spins 0.7.
Yeah.
Fine, that's dynamic.
Yeah. Well, I think if you find it's heavier but it's negative chi, then we would probably say it's dynamical. If it's positive chi, then it's more uncertain, I think.
Okay.
So you assiduously avoided saying anything about rates, but can you say anything about rates as a relative rates?
So let's just. So this is the metallicity. So the big thing, right, will be at the low metallicity, you lose less through winds, so you'll need less massive stars, which means you'd have more in these objects than you would at this end, where you basically need more massive stars to get the same core mass at the end. So if you did this in terms of star mass, right, these curves basically spread out on this axis, and these high metallicity ones would come out over here. You'd need very massive stars to start with, whereas these ones you'd need less massive stars. And then, you know, IMF would say you'd get more of them at this point.
Or maybe to phrase it a more leading question,
yeah.
Is your metallicity threshold such that you should expect to find in the local universe?
So the metallicity is, so basically at this point the stars are losing so much mass that you don't make a big enough star to undergo pulses, so you probably shouldn't, unless you do a merger. So if you merge the two cores, you can still then be heavy enough to do pulses, but you're probably not making the binary black holes, you might just be making single massive black holes at that point. Yes?
What are the prospects for improving the uncertainty, squeezing the uncertainty in the carbon 12 plus alpha reactor rate by other means, direct experiments?
So I mean, people keep doing this, and every few years there's a new paper with a new revised rate. I'm not a nuclear theorist, so I think it's just a case of more experiments and trying to come up with better ways to measure it. It's a problem, A, because it's got large uncertainties, but B, it's also a key reaction rate in the chain. So hopefully the nuclear theorists can do better. So the problem with the things like the white dwarfs is then the convective overshoot is important.
In
the progenitor. Whereas these ones, the overshoot doesn't really matter, so you kind of you can ignore that problem.
But if you could actually measure like the C12 to 16 ratio in the core of a white dwarf, doesn't that give you a constraint that's not?
But I think you still have the degeneracy, right, with your initial mass, with your overshoot plane, kind of where what this was. I mean, people do try, and I think I don't think the constraints are great at this point, but maybe I'm wrong.
There is a claimed astroseismic measurement of like the CETO ratio as a function of depth and white dwarf.
Yeah.
So I looked at how carbon, oxygen, white dwarfs freeze, and in principle there's some sensitivity to the phase diagram, but it's, unfortunately it's not.
But of course it does mean you can do the converse and say black holes can help teach you about white dwarfs, but
So the models that invoke tidal mixing to kind of skip the red giant. How robust is that against variation in the assumed tidal
models? So you don't need so there is quite a range with default assumptions for the tidal forces for this, for in terms of mass period. So I think you probably could, if you started playing around with the tides, you probably shift where the masses and the periods would need to be to do the spin up. I mean, the problem there, of course, is you've got to stop them from merging on the main sequence if they're too close at the start. But
I think there's always going to be a window, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.